Welcome to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast all about stories of safety leadership, presented by Dale Carnegie and the Board of Certified Safety Professionals.
Today, we have a unique guest, which brings us some background that not all our other guests have had. So this will be a great opportunity for our listeners, John, to gain some experiences that somebody else has lived that we can learn from. And you know her fairly well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I'm excited for the conversation as well. I'm fortunate to call Heather a mentor for me and somebody that I look to for guidance. And so excited to bring Heather McDougall to the show and talk a little bit about some of her experiences. So Heather, welcome.
Thank you.
Talk to us a little bit about, you know, your background is very dynamic. And so how did you get into safety?
Well, I'm a lawyer. And so I started out my career as a labor and employment lawyer representing employers. And I definitely did some health and safety work in that space. But I was more of a traditional labor lawyer for the first few years of my career. And there was a point in time when George W. Bush was elected, and I was in Washington, D.C., and my name came up for an agency, the National Labor Relations Board. And I was vetted for that, but somebody else got it. And they said I would have been the youngest board member ever at that point. So they asked me to go and be chief counsel at some other agency, and it was the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. So I had some experience in that space, but that was really a fork in the road where that became my primary focus in my career. And it started from the point, again, of being a lawyer. And at the Review Commission, at that point, I was the chief counsel to the chairman. And then later, I went back there as a commissioner. And then when President Trump was elected, I was elevated to be the chair of that commission. And I didn't really become a true safety professional until after that. So like my background in this space is really formed from the beginning as being a lawyer.
So then you moved from this commission into a new and different role. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I was still at the Review Commission, and it's kind of a long story about how I got to Amazon, but at some point somebody reached out to me and said that Amazon was creating a new role. It was going to be a chief safety officer, and Amazon had somebody who was a VP of safety. It had been already a priority. It was just that as Amazon grew, this individual had a pretty big scope of other functions, sustainability and product compliance and other things. And so they got to this point where they decided they wanted to break safety out and have it be a VP, a single-threaded leader is what they call it at Amazon, of safety. So they let me know they were looking for somebody for this role, and I gave them a few names of people they should consider. And I thought that was kind of the end of it. And at some point they came back and said, what would it take for you to talk to us? You know, those other people were great, but we'd really love to sit down and talk to you. And so then, you know, the conversation continued, and I had to really think about how I would do that, how I would leave the Review Commission, because I was still within the tenure of my term. And so eventually we worked it out, and I became the first single-threaded leader of safety at Amazon.
So what is it that intrigued you about this role that you said, no, this is pretty fascinating? And is there anything that scared you?
You know, to be honest, I think I thought it was an incredible opportunity for someone. It just seemed like, wow, you know, this is Amazon, and they're so innovative, and they use technology, and they're doing incredible things. And how could a person step into this role and have that sort of culture and use that in terms of growing safety within Amazon and the organization? So I was very excited about the opportunities. You know, I think perhaps one of the things that I learned from that is to ask more questions, because I think when I got to Amazon, there were things I realized I didn't know in terms of the operations, and I was just so excited about the challenge of it. And I love a challenge. I love to go places where I feel like I can make an impact and build a great team and a great system. So I was very excited about the opportunity, And I think had a little bit of, and I think we all do as we go into new roles. We, you know, we don't know everything we're getting into until you get there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, so it was, originally I thought she might be from Texas, kind of go big or go home, right? So the highest review commission and then one of the largest companies. And then as you got into Amazon, you know, and I don't want to scare the safety professionals because now we're going to have some bad memories, but then COVID hits.
Right.
And you were on the forefront of that. And it wasn't that long before you got there. So talk a little bit about to the listeners what that looks like going into probably the most or one of the most dynamic businesses during that time.
And could you give us a little bit of the time frame just so we can see when you started compared to when COVID started and the like?
Yeah. So I started with Amazon in, I think it was April 1st of 2019. And it was interesting because there was another leader. She started the same day as me, and she was the new leader of the customer fulfillment portion of Amazon operations. So a really big part of Amazon operations, you know, all those fulfillment centers, and most of those have thousands of employees. So she and I started together, and we did a lot of our onboarding together for about 6 months. I mean, Amazon has a really great onboarding program. So we didn't come out of that until, I guess that would be October of 2019. And, you know, then we know what started to happen because we had operations in China and around the world. We started to see this unfold by December. So it was really a couple of months into our official time in the role that we started to have to deal with this pandemic. And it was definitely it was a lot, you know, as it was for all of us as safety professionals. But, you know, at Amazon, it was, I can't remember exactly how many employees that we had at that time, but, you know, over a million. Amazon grew to, I think, 1.5 or 1.6 million employees in the time that I was there. When I started at Amazon, my safety team was about 2,500 health and safety professionals around the world. And when I left, it was 8,500 maybe even 9,000. So like there's a lot of growth within Amazon, within my team during that time, while at the same time dealing with all the challenges of the pandemic.
So think about setting a strong vision in a time of changing. Do I wear a mask? Do I not wear a mask? Do I stand away from you? Do I not? Do I need a vaccine? Do I not need a vaccine? All of that change and explosive growth. What were some of the tools that you were using during that time in that innovative spirit to manage some of those things?
I think it's some of the things that we've all put in place during the pandemic, and now we've learned from looking back and how we use those. And there are things such as everybody came to the table or the virtual screen, you know, whatever it may have been at that time, but we came, all of our partners came together wanting to help. And so we stood up a task force, and it was the senior leadership team every day meeting for a very long time. And then there were different sort of business or geographical task force as well. So it was like putting the right structures in place to really get together and evaluate what was going on, to make decisions quickly, and to have all of the partners that you need to move quickly as well. And I can think of a couple examples of just like we had decided we were going to start masks, or we decided we were going to start temperature screening. And it was really a sort of great to me to see how we would come up with designs, and our procurement team and our engineering teams would turn those around into executing them in thousands of sites around the world, you know, within an incredibly short amount of time, sometimes 24 hours. You know, we'd see these plexiglass screening areas for people coming in to be temperature screened when we first had handhelds, you know, and then we were trying to procure the, you know, you just walk by them. So it was all these iterations. We had robotics teams, we had software development teams that came up with solutions, such as we called it the social distance assistance. So we would place these screens in high traffic areas where if you walked by a restroom or into the cafeteria or in that turnstile entrances, you would have these cameras that would show you on a screen. And if you were 6 feet from somebody, it would be green. As you got closer, it would be yellow. And then if you're less than 6 feet, it would be red. And, you know, there were teams out there in operations that came up with these ideas and brought them to us. Amazon, I think, was the only employer during the span of the pandemic that built its own testing lab approved by the FDA. And they didn't go out and hire people really that you would think were the folks to do this. I just looked internally and said, you know, you're a great project manager, like help us build this. And by the point that it was fully launched, you know, we were testing thousands of people, I think every minute or every, I don't know what the stat is, but it was like a pretty incredible process to do our own testing so that we were not taking testing capability away from the community when testing was at that point in time, you know, hard to get. And so we were coming up with these solutions that were very at the forefront of what was going on. And it was very much based on everybody wanting to be part of the solution to keep people safe.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that continues to drive home the point of building those relationships and that operational integration in order to enable success. So as you're looking through that, you're managing all of those dynamics, your staff growth was tremendous. How are you able to keep all of that aligned through that dynamic times? What did those communications look like? What did that prep work look like? Because I think a lot of folks that may be listening, they might be single site, but then they're growing, or their company might be doing M&A activities, and so now they're bringing in another company, different culture, different people, different sites. Any tips or tricks on how you're able to manage that explosive growth and keep that centralized vision?
What comes to mind is, one, you have to be aligned on a strategy. So what is the strategy that you implement? And that could be something more formal in terms of you go through the strategic planning exercises for the upcoming year, whenever that may take place. At Amazon, we started in June for the upcoming year. So you have to have kind of bring everybody to the table. So everybody is contributing to the decisions that are made in terms of what is our strategy. And that then makes it much easier for other things to flow from that in terms of goal setting and budget and headcount, because many of those difficult decisions have already been made through the strategic planning exercise. So I think that's really important, is to understand how you're going to create that strategic plan, and then, you know, what those cadences look like and what are the goals and the measurements that you set to evaluate how you're performing against the plan. And then I think it's like all of those partnerships that you have, and it can be at a very high level. And at Amazon, there were different business units, and there would be directors of mine that would lead in the field, essentially, safety, that would partner with those heads of those different business units. You know, so those were the people that really, they had that, you know, they're joined at the hip, or really that very strong partnership, because that's who they would turn to for strategy and, you know, evaluating safety within their business unit, whether it's, you know, the last mile or the middle mile or all the other grocery and specialty operations or customer fulfillment. And they have to have their own cadences as well. And, you know, do they have weekly business reviews, monthly, quarterly, you know, and what does that look like? What goals do they take out of the strategic plan that are specific or relevant to them, and have those conversations within that group? And then there's other things that are more centralized, and, you know, what do those teams look like, and who are their partners? And so, you know, a lot of times what I talk about is just how critical it is within safety for you to figure out who those partners are, and because they have to own safety, and not just own safety like in this, you know, big kind of worldview of it, but just more like, what does that look like in terms of accountability and pushing these initiatives forward and making decisions on them? And then there's all the way down to the shop floor or the warehouse floor or out in the field, you know, whatever your environment is, like, what do those relationships look like for middle managers and frontline managers and engagement with employees? And what are you hearing from them? How do they contribute to the formation of an organization's culture? How do they continue to use that as their toolbox and input into it as you continue to evaluate culture and its impact on the strategy?
Now, even outside of the dealing with the pandemic, were there any things that just surprised you that when you got there and you're looking at it, you said, oh, I didn't really expect this, or I had no idea that this would be a part. Anything that stood out to you like that?
Definitely. Yeah, there definitely were some things that, and that's where I go back to, like, maybe I didn't ask all the right questions, but there were definitely some things where I was surprised, and I thought, wow, I didn't quite know that I, you know, was dealing with this, but there's always going to be that when you come into any organization, you know, any company is at a particular point in their journey, and that's the thing about safety is nobody's mastered it. Nobody's done, and it's always looking at continual improvement. And so, you know, that's what I kind of love about safety and think that everyone shares a very common vision and purpose and comes together to figure out how do we progress on that path? And, you know, how do we continue on our journey, want to reach safety excellence, but knowing, like, you don't ever get there. You know, it's a journey, not a destination.
And John, that ought to be a great encouragement to everyone that listens, because sometimes we want things to go well and we're aiming for that, but oh, I'm just can't quite get it together yet. And the fact that it is a continual growth, it will never be exactly the way we want. We don't like it that way, but if you're in the middle of that right now, it's okay. That's a part of the growth.
Yeah, and I think a lot of what Heather is saying around drive yourself upstream and get into the planning, because then you have an influence on that growth. I think of a story where an individual says, well, I own safety. And Heather touched on this around, what does that mean? Well, it means safety stops with me. Okay, we got that part. Well, what does that mean? It means I own safety. We covered that too. But that there wasn't a tactical or strategy plan for that individual. How does that show up every day? Yeah. And that, so Heather, how can safety professionals that maybe are struggling to try to drive that process? They want to help design that journey as part of it, not necessarily someone that just executes it. How can they drive upstream into that strategy?
I think it starts with those one-on-one conversations. So it can be at all levels of an organization. And I think when you first get into a new role or a new organization, it's really important for you to schedule one-on-ones with all of your partners and then the people above and the people a step below to really understand what motivates them, what are the things they are concerned about, how are they measured, what metrics are they looking at. And if they say to you, it could be the opposite. It could be, I don't own safety. You own safety. You're the safety department. You own safety. Then you know you really have some work to do in terms of changing hearts and minds of people. So I think whatever you get from those one-on-ones will be really helpful. Hopefully they are almost the opposite of, like, what are you expecting from me? What does success in my role look like to you? And how can I make your life and your job easier? So understanding all of that and then kind of taking that forward into the next steps of strategic planning and building that trust and letting those people that you had those conversations with be part of that process. So they understand when a decision is made and a strategic plan is set, that it wasn't something that you just came up with and you're now expecting them to deliver on. You know, they came to the meeting and were involved in the process, and together you all reached this plan or these goals. And that, I think, is a good way for success to start, is to make sure that they're just not saying, like, hey, that's not my plan or my strategy. You came to that together, and then once the decision is made, you have to move forward and figure out how you're going to execute on it.
So what was a major victory that you had going once you got into the position, you're rolling with things, and you said, oh, this is a big one that we need to take place in the area of safety? Was there anything like that that you saw that this helped your momentum to get going and continue to go the way you wanted?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one we already talked about was just creating those stronger partnership. And the pandemic for many organizations, I think, like, brought safety to the table in a new way. And hopefully those organizations, and I think they have continued to lean into safety and recognizing that they need to be that seat at the table. I call it the four-legged stool, yeah, you know, in terms of like it has safety and operations and HR and finance, and they all need to be equal legs of those stools. But the, really, the reality is there's so many other partners that are out there today that are other legs or hovering over the stool. And it's, you know, it's robotics and procurement and legal and could be PR. But so there's all these other partners that really need to come together, and it may depend on the issue, who's really at the table or on the stool. But, you know, you have to figure that out. And I think that was probably my, I would say one of my first feelings of really good about something is just recognizing how those relationships and those partnerships were growing. And we were setting up the org structure to really further those. I often say to others, like, look at where safety sits within your organization. And if you're in a small organization, safety may wear multiple hats. You know, it may be loss prevention. It may be sitting in HR. It may not be just safety as the single-threaded team. But look at where you sit, and does it have the equivalence of those other areas like HR or operations or finance? And too often, safety is layered down in one of those other functions of either finance or HR. And we can have a healthy debate about that. But in my view, I feel like safety should be separate from those, and they should really be an equal partner in all of those. Because if you don't, it's really, it becomes more challenging to get people to listen to you, to have them trust you, to have that credibility, and to really come to the strategic planning with everybody treating you as an equal partner and owner in all of this. So that's one of the things that I first learned. I would say along the way there were some things that dealt with technology, and I think that's one of the great things about the place that safety as a profession sits today is just how technology and innovation can be such an enabler to improving safe operations. And we decided when I was at Amazon that we wanted to reduce and eliminate forklift incidents. Because those are the types of incidents that are, you know, what you would call SIF. At Amazon, it was SIR. But, you know, how do you eliminate that kind of accident in a workplace? And so we went to some OEMs and partnered with them and asked them to come up with technology alongside Amazon to essentially, you know, create a forklift that was like some of the other things that are out there, autonomous vehicles or vacuums. You know, how do we deal with some of the human risk that's inherent in forklift operations? So we partnered with them and piloted some technologies and came up with something called collision avoidance technology that uses LIDAR and RTLS. And it started out as a pilot, you know, probably six sites, and then grew in the next year to another goal of 10 times that, and that had another goal of how we were going to deploy that across all of our operations that used PIT. And saw just incredible results from...
Yeah, tell us a little about the results and what turned out with that.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a complete game changer in terms of... these forklifts were able to identify racking, pedestrians, other forklifts, and slow the forklift down before it got and impacted something else, you know, even objects on the floor. So there are different iterations of it, but it would deal with the human error that can happen in operating a forklift. And I think that's a great thing about what we can look at now through a new safety lens is how do you put those processes in place that look at the problems of the process and the system rather than the actions or behaviors of employees. And so that's what this technology can do. And we ended up getting the Green Cross Innovation Award from NSC, I think it was 22, maybe 23, for that technology. Wow. So that was, yeah, I mean, it was just like, you know, and it was, again, wasn't just, I didn't come up with the idea. There are folks out there in Amazon, including the robotics team and the safety team, who came up with this idea and really worked really closely with OEMs to come up with a solution once we identified the problem. And I think that's one of the things that safety professionals are really great about is like identifying the problem, but also the solution. And then how do you get everybody to join you in the journey of implementing, developing that solution?
And I think that that's where the story comes in, because going back to one of your points around the importance of safety in an organization and somehow that it's can be different. And you know, we've talked in the past about, you know, the rise of a CHRO or a CISO or a chief sustainability officer, and they're triple digits. But we don't necessarily see that with the chief safety officer over that same time period. The storytelling as it relates to increasing the value and visibility of safety. Can you talk a little bit about, you get to Amazon, you don't know everybody, but you fully engage, you're building those partnerships, and you start to increase that visibility and value. So how, if you're a safety professional and you're trying to figure out, man, this sounds great, how do I do that?
Yeah, I think it's articulating that vision for safety, and it shouldn't be around claims data. I mean, that's just my viewpoint, but I too often hear people talk about, oh, we need to show return on investment, and it oftentimes involves claims data. I never used that information when I was putting together a white paper. I would have to really go ask to even get access to it, because that's just not how I thought about things, how the team thought about things, or even the organization. You know, there's other reasons why we invest in safety, and it has to, again, tie back to that vision and that strategic plan. And then again, all of this becomes an exercise of what is included in that plan. And there's always going to be things that are above the line and below the line. Like there aren't unlimited resources, whether it comes to money in terms of CapEx or when it comes to headcount. So, you know, that's how I look at it, is like, how do you create that vision and that strategy and then build your programs around that and tell that story to convey the importance of it, or how you should prioritize things and get other people on board with it and then owners in it as you implement and look at the effectiveness of it.
And did you find that, Heather, in humanizing the stories, of making them somewhat about human beings and the results for human beings and their well-being, their safety, was that of assistance when you're selling your ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the importance of safety, right? You know, this is all about people. And that's one of the things I love about this profession is I mentioned how I love that it's challenging and it's complex. But at the bottom, the heart of it, it's, you know, really about people. And so I love that there's this complexity to it and trying to figure out systems. And continual improvement, but bringing it back again to the reason we do all of this, which is the importance of people and the passion that we have for the work that we do. So when you can tie it back to that and the importance of that, the importance of your people to your organization, I think it helps companies, especially, you know, big companies these days where they're more focused on things like human capital management and how their board is reporting on that. You know, how do you tell that story to the board so that they're engaged on the things that you're doing as well? And they also can then respond in their role of how they're addressing that issue, how they're contributing to the strategy, to the culture, and understanding how people and the projects that we do tie into all of that.
And there is an element where the data helps us know where we're at, gives us measuring sticks, and does all of that. But when we get lost in that data and we forget that these are men, women, people, individuals, sons, daughters, somebody's their loved one that's involved with this, when we can capture that also, and I think it has to come from the safety person who is reminding people of that, that is what helps the people as human beings say, I got to be interested in each other, and we have to watch out for these human beings.
Absolutely. And I don't think you can get there if you're not engaging with people. So you need to have those conversations on the floor or in the field. You need to know people as they are and they come to work and what they bring to work with them. And understand how managers have a lot of things going on in their minds as well. And, you know, how can you help them? So at so many different touch points. It's about people, and how do you get that feedback? So you should have some kind of programs that give employees the opportunity to talk about what's going on in their perception, what's going on with safety in your organization. And it can be perception surveys, or it can be with, you know, today there's so many other ways to do it on a more frequent basis. At Amazon, we had something called the Safety Leader Score. So each day an employee would log in, whether they're pick or stow or packing or whatever they may be doing. At some point, they have a prompt on a screen that asks them a series of rotating questions. And these have been statistically put together. They're rotating questions, but each day it's, you know, a question that asks them how they feel about safety in the workplace. And they stay consistent for the most part so that you're able to validate how they change and tie it back to managers. And so every day Amazon is getting over 1 million points of data about how employees perceive safety or the value placed on safety in their sight and with their manager. And these scores are really very closely tracked in terms of a KPI. And it's something that when the senior business team meets weekly, safety is always the first thing that's discussed. And I think that's, you know, like a great way to set up your systems and your organization is to always lead with safety. And so in this meeting, it was 90 minutes, if I'm recalling correctly. And safety always went first. And if something happened and there was a deep discussion that particular week, you know, the teams that came at the end of the deck were the ones that got shorted, not safety. Always safety first. And those SLI scores were part of the deck. And, you know, each business leader would have their score, and it would trickle down as far as you wanted to get into the data. And there would be resources for those managers that needed, you know, if they would be paired up with somebody who would help them. There's a library of resources. So it's not just about performance management. It's also about development. You know, how do we put capability building into our system so that managers and leaders are given the tools that they need to help with the strategy and the culture?
Yeah, and I want to build on that just a little bit, because I think it's a novel concept that safety professionals should consider is, are we intentionally going after that input, or is it more of an auxiliary input, meaning it's just by happenstance, you know, or do we actually target that input? And so when you think about the role of mentoring in safety, both your staff, both your executive team, because your role was sitting at the very top. What did that look like? Was that a targeted effort for you? Was that intentional around that development as well? So you almost have advocates in these, you know, locations that you could not physically be at just because of the breadth of the organization.
Yeah, I think, again, it goes back to like looking at your organizational structure and how do you set up that structure to better your strategy, but also really develop the people who contribute to it in terms of their career development and having a plan in place and having them get the skills that they need within your own team, your own safety team, because even people who are in the safety profession, they need to continually build their skills and learn. Like, I'm still learning all the time. And you mentioned at the start that you consider me a mentor. I consider you a mentor too. Like, you know, that's the great thing about safety is you're never done learning, and you can learn from so many different people at different industries, different stages in their career. And that curiosity should always be encouraged to continue to learn, because it benefits us at whatever stage we're at. So within an organization, it's really important to have those career development plans and to look at your training. But I would also add, look at your training and make sure it's not too much training, because I think that's what a lot of companies find when they really start looking at their training curriculum, is they might have 100, you know, 100 courses, and they don't need 100. They need like 5 or 10, you know. And I think that's one of the things that can help you build that trust and create credibility with your partners, you know, especially at that more like middle manager stage, is they have so many things to do. And if you come at them with a new program, a new initiative, initially their reaction is going to be, you know, another. So how are you being effective with their time? And one of the ways you can probably pull some of that back is like look at your training curriculum, and there's probably too much in there. So how do you develop capability building that's effective and really is the best investment for your resources and their time?
And even that spirit of curiosity, when the leader models this, that I'm curious, I'd like to know, I'd like to understand, then it lets everybody else know it's all right to say, I don't quite know that. And that probably ought to be even when we recruit and hire safety professionals, we talk about competencies they need to have. Rarely do we say curiosity is a competency. But for every leader, especially the safety leader, wanting to learn from other people, how'd you do that? How'd you know that? Is quite the key.
So let's go back a little bit. A friend of mine usually uses the term, now what, so what? Meaning we're going to do this thing, what's going to change? And that was a measuring stick of whether or not, you know, the investment was worth it. And so as you think about prioritizing your time and your efforts within your own safety group, what were those things that were top of mind for you and your staff outside of operations of saying, we can only get so much done? And so where's that ROI? What should we pursue this year?
Yeah, I think when you begin that process, that planning process, a lot of ideas is good. I think I read recently somewhere like you don't kind of hit the point of more ideas are bad until you get to like 100 ideas from a person. Like the peak point is like 20 ideas a person. And so like to plant 1,000 flowers, I think is how I heard it. Like to get a lot of ideas is a good thing. And then again, because of this kind of critical process of evaluating, you figure out what ones tie in with your strategy. And they can be around looking at the data. It could be the types of injuries that you're seeing. I mean, obviously as safety professionals, when we go through this planning exercise, you need to have the data. What are the top contributors to injuries in your workplace? And are there things like the tenure of your employees that stand out? Are there things that are serious incidents? And although the frequency is low, we don't want to ever see somebody lose a limb. Like, so are there things that, why are we investing in them? And how do they fit in with this plan? And there can be things around having better EHS information management. And, you know, so like, how does that fit in? It's how do we improve our change management and prevention through design framework so that safety has a better seat at every stage of the toll gates? You know, how are they involved earlier so that we can be addressing issues before they become incidents? So how do we change our buildings, our processes, so that we are looking at them early on in the process? Because, I mean, one of the things I don't think that people always understand, in many businesses, when you start coming up with an idea for a process or a building, the point in time that you start to develop those plans to the time it ends up in a building could be 5 years. You know, so if you're talking about something that you see in a building today, you had to begin to think about it at that very early stage of the planning. And how did safety fit into that development to make sure that they had a seat at the table to try and cut off some of those issues, to deal with the risk that may not have been evident to, you know, some other team?
You have blazed some trails as a woman to accomplish things. And I know there are many women that are in the field and working with safety and leading safety. What other advice would you have for them to even help them be more effective in what they're doing?
You know, I think one of the things that I repeat is that men are oftentimes picked for opportunities, and it could be a project, doesn't have to be a role, but based on their perceived potential, whereas studies show that women often have to show the experience for something first. So to think about that, and how do we create equal opportunity? And so can you ask a woman to have an opportunity based on her potential rather than her experience, I think helps women progress because there are fewer women in the safety profession, just as there are fewer women in many professions. But like, how do we continue to bring women into the profession and give them those opportunities so that they can develop and continue on their journey to get into successively bigger and better positions? So how do you invite those women to the table? Because I think sometimes perhaps, there are different skill sets that men and women have, and that's great, you know, and that's what we want, is that diverse perspective is something we want everybody to be able to bring themselves to work and to the table, and our decisions really become better from that.
And I think if you're a male listening to this podcast, what I would offer from my own personal experience is many of the key lessons I've ever learned have been from women mentors. And so if there's a stigma around that, you can quash that, because you should be looking at your slate of folks that are either mentoring you or you're mentoring, and make sure that it's a diverse platform. Because if you streamline that, then you get streamlined results.
Yeah, the well-rounded and opening up more perceptions. And I think certainly one of the Carnegie principles is give the other person a fine reputation to live up to. And I think that as we're building those people around us, men and women, give them a reputation of what you see that they can be and encourage them to go that way. And certainly, Heather, you, through your legal work and then in Amazon, have set some paces for people. So as folks are listening to this, there are folks listening there saying, well, I'm not the level of Amazon. That's not me, and I'm not an attorney. But what is it that you would encourage people in the realm of safety and what they're doing and as they're leading others? What's a couple of thoughts that you'd give to encourage them going forward?
I think it goes back to, again, like, advocate for our profession and where it should sit with an organization, and make sure that you're given the respect that safety and you deserve. And so, you know, how you have that conversation with your organization may differ, and perhaps it means like it's not going to work out there, but you know that. But like, that's what we should be trying to do, is make sure that safety as a profession is given the respect that it deserves. And it should be like the chief sustainability officer and other chief officers and all of those teams. Like, we, our work, and everyone knows that, our work is so important. And it's something that not only we have passion for, but the entire organization should, and I think most of the time does, share that passion. But that should be reflected in the org structure and the processes that we put in place. They need to be valued at the same level as some of the other functions.
And not to think of ourselves as pompous, but we're just not the little old safety person. We're not that. We're here to make a difference for the lives of human beings and to help guide and be a part of this culture setting that's taking place in the organization. And that is the great opportunity and oftentimes the great challenge.
It is. It is like there's definitely a tension between, you know, sometimes we want to own it and sometimes our partners want us to own it. But we need to really figure out that balance of, you know, what does that partnership look like? And how do we essentially become the coach of the coaches so that they're really effective at the work they need to do as our partners, but also recognizing like we're indispensable in that process.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming and sharing your experiences and your story to be of help to all the listeners and to each of us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Heather delivered the goods. I mean, a lady of experience from her legal background, moving into that role of Amazon. One thing, John, that I stood out to me that we don't always think of for a safety professional. She said, we need to learn to write well to get our story across. And we sometimes don't take time to do that, but that ability to communicate our story so that people can see it in our head, that's a big thing.
Yeah, and I'm fortunate that I get some time to spend around her and pick her brain on some things, and we were it was good to share that with our audience. I think one of my large takeaways for this one is this: disagree and commit. And I think we can get uncomfortable with disagreement, and we sometimes don't pursue what we believe is the right thing because we're uncomfortable. So it's okay to have disagreement, and you're not always going to be lined up on things. But once a decision is made, let's commit to it and let's follow through.
And that ability to get the idea and concept refined through some healthy disagreement is vital for everybody.
Yeah, makes everybody better.
Thanks for listening to My Big Safety Challenge, a podcast produced in partnership by Dale Carnegie and BCSP, with your host, Dale Carnegie Master Trainer Merle Heckman, and John Fisher, Director of Environmental Strategy and Corporate EHS at Duke Energy Corporation. Executive produced by Joel Bergai. Directed by Giachi Liu. Edited by Jared Grio and Kyla Anderson. Editorial support from Brandon Mohaupt. Social media support from Braylon Morgan. Consulting producers are Colin Brown and Mark Sullivan. To have new episodes delivered directly to you, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. If you'd like to share your story of a safety leadership challenge you faced, email us at info@mybigsafetychallenge.com. See you next time.